My name was Salmon, like the fish. First name, Susie. I was 14 when I was murdered on December 6th, 1973. With these haunting words, we enter a story told from the most unexpected perspective, that of a teenage victim watching her family from heaven. In suburban Pennsylvania, Susie follows her neighbor Mr. Harvey into an underground room he built in a cornfield, overriding her instinctive wariness out of politeness. What happens next is presented with unflinching honesty yet remarkable restraint. 3 days later, a dog discovers her elbow, the first evidence in what becomes an unsolved murder case haunting her community for years. What makes this narrative approach so powerful is how it subverts expectations. We immediately know who the killer is, but remain powerless to communicate this to those left behind. We become observers alongside Susie, watching her family's desperate search for answers and their struggle to continue living in the shadow of unimaginable loss. This tension creates a unique reading experience where we feel both the intimate connection of first-person storytelling and the helpless distance of watching events unfold beyond our control. In Susie's experience, heaven isn't a universal paradise, but a personalized reflection of each soul's deepest desires and unfinished business. Her heaven initially resembles a 1960s suburban high school, the experience she'll never have. She dreamed of attending Fairfax High, reinventing herself as Suzanne, with feathered hair, becoming both popular and kind. Heaven expands as Susie meets others. Her roommate Holly, a Vietnamese girl reading on a swing set, becomes her first friend. Together, they create a duplex overlooking a park and an ice cream shop where peppermint stick is never seasonal. Their intake counselor, Franny, explains that heaven provides their simplest dreams and grows through desire. This conception balances comfort with limitation. Heaven gives Susie what she wants, but not what she needs most: justice and reunion with her family. Despite heavenly pleasures, Susie remains fixated on Earth, watching through a gazebo that serves as her window to the living world, a tension that drives the novel's emotional core. How does a family survive the unimaginable? The Salmon family's response to Susie's murder reveals how tragedy both unites and divides, with each member processing grief differently. Jack Salmon channels his anger into obsessively pursuing his daughter's killer. Convinced George Harvey is responsible, he gathers overlooked evidence, finding purpose but alienating those who need him most. Abigail Salmon withdraws emotionally, then physically. Unable to bear reminders of her daughter, she begins an affair with Detective Fennerman before fleeing to California to work at a winery. Lindsay bears the burden of grief while being the sister of the murdered girl. She hardens herself through physical discipline, sit-ups, marine-style push-ups, focusing only on the in, the out. She avoids mirrors and showers in darkness, suffering when others see Susie instead of her. 4-year-old Buckley initially believes Susie will return. As he grows, his grief transforms into anger at his father's stalled mourning. His raw accusation, "She's dead, but what about us?" forces his father to see how his obsession with the dead has harmed the living. George Harvey's terror lies in his ordinariness, a solitary dollhouse builder who keeps to himself. Through Susie's omniscient perspective, we witness both his public persona and private monstrosity, creating a disturbing study in the banality of evil. To neighbors, Harvey seems merely odd but harmless. When Detective Fennerman investigates Jack Salmon's suspicions, he finds nothing remarkable. Harvey explains away the yard tent as a tribute to his wife, easily deflecting suspicion. Behind this unremarkable facade lurks a serial killer whose crimes span decades. After murdering Susie, he meticulously cleans himself, feeling calm flood him as warm water washed me away. His pleasure at her muffled scream reveals his sadistic nature. Harvey keeps trophies from victims, simple objects like a wedding ring, a letter, a shoe heel, including Susie's Pennsylvania Keystone charm, counting them like rosary beads at night. This portrait shows how predators hide in plain sight, protected by social conventions that require evidence over intuition. Amidst the darkness shine moments of profound connection, offering paths toward healing. These relationships don't erase grief, but provide strength to carry it forward. Lindsay and Samuel's relationship forms the novel's most hopeful thread. His gift of a half-heart pendant after Susie's death begins a bond that allows Lindsay to reclaim her identity beyond the sister of the murdered girl. When they discover an abandoned Victorian house during a rainstorm, Samuel proposes and vows to restore it, a metaphor for rebuilding life after tragedy. Even broken relationships find healing. When Jack suffers a heart attack, Abigail returns after years away. Their reunion is tentative but tender. Hello, ocean eyes. Look what it took to get you home. Though unable to promise permanence, Abigail commits to try, acknowledging healing as ongoing rather than absolute. The novel's most powerful connection comes when Susie briefly returns through Ruth's body, experiencing physical intimacy with Ray that death had denied her, a moment where the boundary between living and dead temporarily dissolves. As time passes, Susie discovers that the lovely bones aren't her physical remains, but the connections forming after her death, the relationships that create a living memorial. Watching her family celebrate Lindsay and Samuel's engagement, Susie reflects, "These were the lovely bones that had grown around my absence. The connections, sometimes tenuous, sometimes made at great cost, but often magnificent, that happened after I was gone." She sees the world without me in it, understanding that the price of this miraculous body of connections was her life. This insight marks Susie's transition from obsessive watching to gradual release. She becomes manifest in whatever way they needed me to be, a memory, inspiration, or guiding presence. The novel ends with a man showing his wife Susie's mud-encrusted charm bracelet. When his wife remarks, "This little girl's grown up by now," Susie responds, "Almost, not quite," acknowledging both her eternal youth and her growth through witnessing her family's journey. The novel's final message, simultaneously heartbreaking and hopeful, is that life inevitably continues after devastating loss. This continuation isn't a betrayal of the dead, but the natural order they must accept. Life's milestones arrived despite absence. Lindsay graduates, marries Samuel, and becomes pregnant. Buckley grows from a confused child to a young man. Ray becomes a doctor, Ruth documents spirits, and Abigail returns. Each character carries Susie's absence differently. Lindsay's wound has been braiding into a scar for 8 long years. Buckley's heart flashes from heart to stone as he struggles with abandonment. Grief evolves, becoming integrated into their identities. From heaven, Susie accepts this continuation. "You don't notice the dead leaving when they really choose to leave," she observes. "It's like a woman slipping out of a lecture hall." The image of Lindsay's daughter, named Abigail Suzanne, Little Susie, playing in the garden while Susie watches from heaven, completes this theme, proving love survives even terrible loss.